recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov. And the goal here, of course, at ESI Bytes is to attempt to bring nationally known speakers to the listeners at a price everyone can afford, which is free, at a time when you might actually be interested in listening to a topic. All the topics are about electronic discovery or records management. Today we've got a really neat show, early assessment tips from Kevin Esposito. And Kevin is a director of legal of electronic discovery at MetaJury Incorporated. And in his role at MetaJury, Kevin drives the analysis and implementation of processes and tool sets that are designed to decrease the cost of complying with legal discovery obligations without sacrificing legal defensibility. Prior to joining MetaJury, Kevin was the co-founder of the discovery response team at Pfizer in New York, where he helped to lead the company's corporate record retention efforts. As director of electronic discovery at Pfizer, he was responsible for day-to-day operations of the IT side of the electronic discovery process and coordinated electronic discovery efforts worldwide. Prior to this, Kevin developed and managed global technology support organizations for United Parcel Service for over a decade before he became an attorney. Kevin's also a founding member of the Electronic Discovery Reference Model, EDRM.net, where he served as the first co-chair of the Code of Conduct Subcommittee. Kevin also was the million-dollar bill in the Discoveryland board game I created, which will always bind us together in the eDiscovery world, Kevin, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, let's get started here. First of all, I always like to ask, how did you first become interested in electronic discovery? And how does it feel to be on a million-dollar bill in a leading e-discovery strategy game?
Well, Carl, you know, the old saw says that some men are born to a destiny and some have it thrust upon them. I definitely had my role in this industry thrust upon me by circumstance and the corporate general counsel who was confronted with absolutely stratospheric discovery costs. We agreed it would be great if we could find a way of rechanneling even a fraction of what we were spending on discovery back into our business and helping to develop new products. I had a couple of decades in the information technology world, as you'd mentioned earlier, prior to becoming an attorney, and since most of the costs that were involved in electronic discovery are either caused by the implementation of technology within the business or through the processing of data that you extract from those technology resources, I was a natural choice for trying to bridge the worlds of technology and the law. You know, as for being the star of the million-dollar bill, I can tell you that it's better than being on a stamp. After all, you got to die in order to be on a stamp. So I'm fairly honored by being part of such an important strategy game.
Great. Let's talk about early case assessment, the topic of today's show. What are the steps in an electronic discovery model for early case assessment?
Well, you know, unlike some other discovery commentators, I've got to fall back on the old law school response of, it really depends.
Well, that's fine, but you've always been one of the most vocal proponents of using structured processes to reduce discovery costs. So, you know, let me rephrase it. How does this apply to case assessments?
Well, I applaud the use of models and checklists, but unfortunately, I think that people have let the pendulum swing a little bit too far now and expect every single case to follow some sort of formula or standard process. And unfortunately, that's just not practical. That's not what we see in real life. There's a tendency of some people to think that every case can be boiled down to some simple process. If you follow the process, check the boxes, presto, everything's predictable. You know, I maintain from extensive experience that that's not what's going to be happening in real life. I'm an active member of EDRM, as you mentioned, and I support efforts to apply some level of rigor to the discovery process, but I run into far too many clients who think that all you need to do is to whip out a diagram from your pocket, take a little Kentucky windage, fill out a spreadsheet, and then you can dramatically announce what the legal exposures are and what the total case cost is going to be. You know, I would submit that such expectations underestimate the complexity that can present itself in any particular matter, and it also devalues the legal advice that lawyers provide.
Okay, well, why is cost reduction through assessment relevant today?
Well, I think it's relevant for a number of reasons. First of all, you've got the amount of information, as we've been talking about for a number of years now in the electronic discovery world. The data within organizations continues to explode. The continued use of computers will result in larger data pools, which then translates into additional costs during discovery. You really can't get away from that. That's going to be an ongoing issue we need to deal with. Number two, litigation's always going to be with us. So we know that there's been a downturn because of the economy, and perhaps some people have been holding off from engaging in litigation for a number of reasons, but eventually things are going to rebound, and as they do, budgets are going to begin to free up and more litigation is going to be forthcoming. So you're always going to need to respond to requests for data. The question of what is accessible, quote-unquote, data, you know, continues to get expanded through the implementation of new technologies. And stonewalling is, as we've said for a couple of years now, it's not an option. You can't stonewall, so you're not going to be able to either technologically or legally say in the future that you can't provide access to information. Number three, most interesting from the social point of view, I suppose, the economy has gone through a meltdown that most of our generation, Carl, have never thought we were going to experience. Our grandparents, with their memories of the Depression and such, might think we're all overreacting. But this is definitely one of the most significant downturns that any of us have ever seen. So most of our generation are now very gun-shy. A lot of people are executing flights to safety, which take on a lot of different forms. In our profession, one part of that flight to safety is to search for more certainty in pricing. Now, people look for certainty in pricing either to protect their own interests or to curry favor with clients by removing a level of uncertainty for them.
You know, I remember 3 years ago, I think it was, there was an attorney from Cisco, I think it was Mark Michaels, Georgetown University, eDiscovery CLE program, and he was talking about hiring a trial litigator right away before you let the e-discovery process take over a case. And that's when people were spending lots of money on litigation before the benefits of an economic downturn, as you just mentioned. So today, litigation spending is sharply curtailed. Should we be now saying that you need to get a discovery expert involved at the start of the case before looking at a trial litigator?
Yeah, I remember what Mark was talking about, and I know where he was coming from. But again, I've got to counsel caution and maybe a little bit of common sense as well. I don't want to grasp for the next one-stop shopping solution. So in the past, you know, everyone said get a litigator involved before you get involved in discovery. And now everyone's saying, well, you know, forget about the litigator, get a hold of some e-discovery people. I don't think you need to reach for any one particular discipline. This really is a team effort that has to be brought forward, so you have to take a look at a lot of different solutions. You've got to have both. You've got to have discovery-specific knowledge and effective trial management and legal strategy, all of which needs to be married with fiscal responsibility. I'd say that it really doesn't matter which order the process plays out, as long as you've got both types of subject matter experts available to assist with all decisions that you're going to need to make in order to keep the case on track and keep it within a reasonable budget.
So then, Kevin, what are some of the key things you think people should take into consideration during a case assessment process? I'm going to get a checklist out of you, Kevin. Okay?
Well, you know, this is what we live with every day. People are really looking for checklists. They've gone to discovery conferences, and they've read articles and LTN and a lot of other, you know, magazines and things. And they're looking for that ability to, you know, check a couple of boxes and presto, everything's done. I think the main thing here is, regardless of whatever process you put in place in order to control all of the efforts, you've got to make sure you've got all of your facts. And I know that sounds simple, but it's really not. A lot of people try to go off with only bits and pieces of information as opposed to pulling everything together. And they begin to make, you know, ultimate decisions either on adjudication or whether they want to press forward with the matter based upon, you know, bits and pieces as opposed to having all their information. You know, a common mistake I see with people who will call us in is that people will try to take a sampling of a few data sources within the organization, slap them all together, have a few lawyers review the output, and then think somehow they're going to extrapolate out to the final result. You'd be surprised how many people will call me and say, well, I'll send you an email from three top execs, and then you tell us what you think of the situation.
Well, how do you respond to such a request?
Well, basically, I tell them I'm a lawyer, not a tea leaf reader. If they want me to provide an effective analysis, I need something more than just a few scraps to work from.
Well, to provide that effective analysis, then, who do you get involved in assessing an electronic discovery case?
Well, you know, in the vernacular of the profession, I have to fall back on the phrase that I think this has been well settled by now. Lots of your listeners have already heard the mantra, you know, recited over and over again at Discovery conferences. But, you know, we'll talk about it here because you really do have a set number of players that you need to include. You know, first of all, you need your IT staff. And a lot of people have heard this message for a few years now to make sure that you've got the people available not only to provide access to data, but also understand how that data is used within the organization, how it's created, how it's disseminated. You need your records management staff, and I'll put a little bit of an asterisk there, not because they're a lesser member or because it's unique, but a lot of organizations no longer have records management staff for a number of reasons, including the, you know, the economic downturn. So, but if you've got them available, you should absolutely be using them. Don't ignore the business people who are responsible for the processes and whatever transactions are at issue. You know, I got to make sure that the business people are involved as well to help to provide context for a lot of the information that's out there. And of course, then, you know, overseeing all of this should be the legal strategy team. But I suppose that I would add maybe one additional player in the form of the finance folks. They have an interest in how Discovery dollars are spent as well. They're in charge of protecting the organization's coffers, and I see a lot of friction between legal people and finance people because the legal people will go off and make some decisions about, well, I want to process, you know, all of my data, and I want to throw everything into a particular repository, and I'm going to have to pay a few thousand dollars a month in order to keep it running. And the finance people go, whoa, who's going to pay for all this? You know, it's best to get them involved from the get-go. This way you don't have any, you know, surprises later on. The IT staff and the business people both play the largest roles in attempting to execute an early assessment because they're going to feed the raw data to you that you'll need to, you know, foster the effective decision-making. Some legal folks might bristle when I say that it's the IT and business people that are key, but I'm a big fan of clearly defined roles and responsibilities. It's the role of IT and the role of the business people to lay out the facts and provide your historical context. It's the responsibility of the legal folks to take the output of those efforts and determine both legal exposures and the strategy for moving forward. So it really is a formal process. It is something that you control. It's something that doesn't take, you know, rocket scientists to put together checklists and controls and ways of tracking information. But you have to have a dedicated process that doesn't change, you know, with the moment. It's got to be something that people have been educated on, people understand, and people are comfortable with.
And just so I understand here, to wrap up this area, if you've put those groups of people together, and then in the context of that group, you go and you sample some data from a couple of key executives, that's not as bad. That may be how you want to proceed, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you want to make sure that you have the proper executives. In my example earlier, you know, people will just say, I'll send you all the email from my CEO, my CFO, and my EIEIO. You know, take that information and tell me if I've got a problem. That's not the way to look at a case. The way to look at the case is to get all of the data from the IT people, get the context of what happened in this particular situation from the business people who were involved, and then sit down with the legal, you know, strategy folks and say, okay, we can massage the data, we can look through it, and we can provide something relevant for you. Now, how does this play out for you? It's not for the outside consultant to come in and sit down with your outside counsel and between the two of them, you know, decide whether this is good, bad, or indifferent. This is a shared responsibility. We're here to help to provide the information, and it's ultimately, you know, the trier of fact in this case, before it gets to court, is the organization, you know, that is under siege. It's that organization who's going to look at the information. They're going to say, either this is something we want to move forward with, or this is something we want to settle. And that's between the corporation and their outside counsel.
And I'll just put a little plug in here. We did a really good podcast with Sherry Harris from Hunt and Williams on e-scoping, which sort of goes into drilling down within, you know, key people. But, you know, next question on early case assessments. For years, in-house people have been writing about their desires for fixed fee litigation, and lawyers at firms have fought back, claiming it hampers their ability to react to the uncertainties in a case, such as how the other side reacts,
right,
how a witness is going to react, how technology works to manage a case, et cetera, especially when it doesn't work well and new facts emerge. despite all the debate today, we still have the billable hours, the primary payment for outside counsel. Doesn't early case assessment sort of suffer from the similar issues that moving off a billable hour does today?
Well, you know, that's interesting, Carl, because, you know, we go back to the case of the swinging pendulum again. You know, many years ago, clients paid retainers to law firms for their advice throughout the year. The clients pushed back, and they said they wanted to pay the law firms based upon the amount of work done, and here we are. We've got the billable hour. The billable hour is born. Now that they pay by the hour, however, clients are now saying they want to pay for a fixed fee. So, you know, go figure. I mean, one of my key rules when I was doing IT development work is that the quickest way to find out what someone doesn't want is to give them precisely what they just asked for. So, you know, the legal profession did respond to what the clients have been asking for, and so now there's a swing back in the other direction. Case assessments suffer from some of the same reactionary sort of thinking. You have to get the client to remember that a case assessment is just that, it's an assessment. There's a lot of people that I've come across that are somehow selling assessments as being a way of ending cases or a way of avoiding cases, and I absolutely don't agree with that. It's an evaluation done at a specific point in time. It's not an adjudication. It's not the the final word in the case. It doesn't mean that that there won't ever be new issues to come to light during the case. It doesn't mean that you're not going to find more data that paints the situation a completely different light. That's where the thinking is similar to fixed fee billable hour debate. You know, pendulum is swinging too far to one side. Originally, no one was doing case assessments. Now, everyone pushes case assessments, and they push it as a way of almost like another form of ADR. You know, one of my partners says he never met a litigator that didn't want to litigate. And in the past, that was fine. It used to be that we would have clients that wanted to litigate everything. We'd counsel them that it might be better perhaps to settle some of the events that, and in turn, we'd be met with that famous phrase, it's not the money that's important, it's the principle. Well, you know, when someone says that to me, it's usually a sign that, A, they're pretty pissed off at the other side, and B, it really is the money that they're after. In my experience, people who are really defending a principle don't have to proclaim that fact, you know, and the money involved is usually a secondary, although well-managed item for them to take issue with. But by contrast, today we have people wanting to use case assessment as a way of justifying the settlement of practically everything that they're hit with. You know, even if there's significant issues at stake, or even if it could set a bad precedent for their business in the future. And I think that's a very dangerous thing. So people initially looked at case assessment as a way of reducing their costs, and now they're using it as a way of perhaps cleaning their docket. And I don't think that that's wise. For some people, people are looking at case assessment as an alternative to litigation, and I kind of scratch my head a little bit at that, where they say, well, I don't know if I'm going to go to litigation on this. I'm going to do a case assessment instead. It's not instead. The case assessment is the beginning of the process. It's just one tool in the litigation toolbox. It's one step in the decision process. It's not the decision process.
Well, who has the skill set today to determine what a case is worth, and importantly, to an eDiscover listening audience, what it will cost?
Back to cost. Well, you know, at the risk of stating the obvious, I have to say that deciding what the case is worth is really a question for the client, and I'm not trying to be evasive there. You know, it's in the case of a corporate client, the worth of the case has to be established by the key decision makers there and the key business executives. The job of the discovery consultant is to lay out for the client the various alternatives available to them for doing work in support of their case, and the costs related to that work. And in that respect, we get involved in cost. As far as the skill set required to establish what a case might cost, I would suggest that it's probably not the same skill set as that needed to establish a good legal strategy, however. There's a lot more of the business element that is involved in that kind of an analysis. You've got to be a good project planner and an administrator. You've got to have a good grasp of the nuts and bolts of the operational issues of the processes that go into the project. You have to have accurate market data on lots of different pricing variables and industry contacts that enable you to move from one alternative to another when either volume or circumstances dictate that you need to make a change. You know, either your processes are overwhelmed or perhaps you just need, you know, additional assistance. You know, a lot of what we do at Metasure is providing structure and process to what some people perceive as an overwhelming issue. You know, we need to be able to assist them by keeping track of multiple variables, we have to have the alternatives out there so we're not painting them into a corner with any one particular process or tool. We have to be able to weigh different pricing options and suggest ways of offering support without crippling the client's finances. The costs involved, if the organization has good historical data as to what they have spent in the past, that's an opportunity for you to be able to use that as a foundation, factor in the costs that you know are out there in the industry, and then extrapolate that to what at least an assessment is going to cost, perhaps even the first or second level of review. If the organization has no historical data, if they don't know what they've been paying for discovery, if they don't know what outside counsel, you know, what percentage of their outside counsel bill is dedicated to things like collection or processing or preparing for review or whatever else have you, then it becomes more challenging. But that's where your responsibility is to help the customer to identify those issues and begin tracking what those costs are. You know, by having at least some of that raw data available, it's going to give the client a much clearer picture as to what things could be in the future. We always like to, you know, in this field, start with a smaller matter, if at all possible, if someone can see they're getting involved in these operations down the road. If they don't, if they're in the middle of a maelstrom, well, then that's when you're going to have to sit down, hunker down, and, you know, begin capturing the data to be able to say, well, look, you know, we might not be able to look into a crystal ball and say, here is definitely what everything will cost you, but here are the unit costs. And you're a business. You know all about unit costs. You use it every day to make your widgets. You know what it costs to build something. You know what it costs to sell it. You know what your margin is. We can take the same sort of an approach to take a look at exactly what these items are, what they cost, and how this is going to impact you down the road.
Well, you're looking at historical performance in that answer, and anytime anyone tries to put their arms around what can be a big number, like the federal budget or bailouts or electronic discovery for that matter, which it potentially can turn into a big number, they tend to underestimate costs. So how can companies who've been burned before get comfortable with an early case assessment number?
Well, you know, if you're speaking specifically about someone who's been burned in the past, I think you have to walk them through a post-mortem of at least one or two of their previous experiences before you can move forward. You know, if they've had a bad experience with discovery, then you have to find out where that prior effort ran off the rails. Perhaps they were trying one of those, you know, tea leaf reading efforts where they had incomplete data. Well, that should be a red flag right there. Perhaps they're trying to, you know, get all their data sources together because they didn't know all their data sources, or maybe they are hard-pressed to respond to demands from the other side because of the format the data was in or something like that. Perhaps they underestimated the volume of data that their custodians were going to be contributing to the discovery process. You got to analyze what happened to the past and fill in the gaps that might have, you know, presented themselves. For those clients that haven't been burned, you know, the process can be even more difficult. In those situations, you might have to start off with a completely blank slate. They may not know how much data is available. They might not know where that data resides. They might not know who the critical custodians are, and some of the other things that we now consider to be discovery basics. You know, that complicates trying to create a case assessment because the elements that go into a solid assessment are also the foundation for effective discovery and effective case management. So unfortunately, that brings us back to the, you know, it depends sort of comment, because I think you have to do the client a disservice if you cave into pressure and simply guess a number for the cost of an assessment, or, you know, guess at what the issues are going to be, or guess at how much time and effort it's going to be required to take one of these things if you don't have your key elements available. You know, in these days of financial uncertainty, many clients are looking for you to state a number and stick to it within the first 15 minutes of being brought into an engagement. The challenge is in getting the client to understand that the critical need is in first obtaining those requisite elements so that both of you can live with any financial estimates you work up after that.
We're talking about, you know, the cost estimates, and, you know, one thing sort of comes to my mind, people that pay for a lot of these matters, do insurance companies play a role in this assessment?
Well, I sure wish they would. I think that they'd be very interested in the efforts of organizations such as mine that are dedicated to, you know, managing and minimizing discovery burdens and costs. You know, unfortunately, I see very little involvement right now in anything outside of a few mass tort actions, which I think is kind of interesting. I'm amazed that insurance companies are not more involved in the discovery processes since, you know, as I think you're alluding to, They're the ones that, you know, provide funding for many cases through the policies that they write. I'm not saying that the insurance company should be able to make any final calls or, you know, decide final dispositions or anything like that, but I do think they've got a valid interest in seeing that efficient and cost-effective processes are used, you know, throughout the case management process. For those cases in which we've been asked to participate by the insurance companies, we've been very successful in getting all sides to see that, you know, financial prudence doesn't necessarily mean that you hamper the efforts of the legal strategy team.
Well, since we've established that an early case assessment isn't the number to live by, you know, what a case is going to be worth, so, you know, once you've completed that case assessment, what does that give you?
Well, basically it gives you a starting point. As I said earlier, it doesn't give you a conclusion. You know, when I got my pilot's license, the examiner gave me my license and said, well, what's that? And I said, well, this is a license to fly. And he answered, no, that's a license to learn. The minute you think you know everything, you're history. And I always remembered that because I thought, you know, that's a pretty interesting way of looking at starting a process that, all right, you've got some basic understanding, you've got some basic education, but you don't know it all. So it's the same with an assessment. You've got a starting point, you know, for further discussion, and you've got a starting point for your decision-making process. The assessment shows you, you know, what cards you've been dealt. You know, in the words of the gambler, you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run. So as I said earlier, it's important to remember that the case assessment is done at a specific point in time. The initial assessment may counsel caution, or it might provide confidence in moving forward, you know, fairly boldly. The initial assessment isn't the last word, however. You need to continually update that assessment, and that feedback loop is something that I see missing all the time. You need to make sure that people are updating the assessment, looking at new information as it becomes available. And regardless, that assessment is going to lead to one of two things, either to an assessment that says, you know, you need to go into settlement talks, or it's going to provide you with information to support full-blown litigation. It's going to point towards a course of action, and it's going to be up to the legal strategy team to decide which way to turn.
Boy, Kevin, you came really close to being the second e-discovery song on our website. We have, you don't bring me paper, which Tom Stevens and I sang. And you, if you'd done a couple more lines, you know, I might have cut and pasted that up there. But
maybe that's something for a future
technologist,
evaluation.
Pilot, lawyer, singer-songwriter. Why not?
Right.
Well, if the legal team has made the decision to settle or litigate, you know, that's the end of the story for the assessment, right?
Well, you know, not quite. No matter what action's taken, you know, you've got that critical step that you've got to make sure doesn't get overlooked.
And what's that, Kevin?
Well, it's the feedback, you know, the feedback loop that I was just talking about. You need to perform a post-mortem in the way that I talked about earlier. If you've got a new client and they don't have previous information, or they may have been burned before and you walk them through a post-mortem and what went wrong, it doesn't matter if something goes right or something goes wrong. This is an operations management tool that I was trained in many, many years ago. If things go well, great. Then you want to find out what were the good elements, what were the things we did well as an organization that helped to foster success. On the other hand, if something went wrong, you're not looking to assess blame. You're looking to figure out, okay, how can we prevent it from happening again? You've got to determine how accurate your initial assessment was and see if it was off in critical areas. So if we do an early assessment for a client and say, well, here's where we think the issues are, you know, in the case based on your data, here are the kinds of things that outside counsel is most concerned about, in working that up, you know, when you finally get to your adjudication or when you finally get to your settlement, you know, it's important to go back and take a look at those initial decisions and say, well, how close were we? And a lot of people don't do that. If you were off in any of your assumptions, you know, any of your pricing elements, or, you know, maybe there were some tactical decisions you want to handle differently, you need to adjust those factors so that you can improve your planning for the new events that might present themselves in the future.
You know, it's remarkable how you ended up at that point. I had Jim Michalowicz do a show on sort of case completion. He was the $500,000 bail in discovery land, and we coined the phrase for EDRM, Electronic Discovery Reference Model, Michalowicz, for his final stage, which was early case assessment. So I guess you can fight him on who can, you know, you probably don't want to call, you know, you throw Michalowicz into anything you brand.
Well, Jim and I will split things between us, I'm sure. We've been working together for quite a long time.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Well, you know, sort of wrapping up on cost containment, because I know people always like to hear thoughts in that area. Does cost containment still play a role in the e-discovery equation?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going to always play a role. I mean, it's part of business. It's part of, you know, the business of the legal profession. I know some people don't like, you know, to talk about the legal profession in that kind of respect. But you need to watch the tendency, though, of becoming penny wise and pound foolish. You know, I've seen a lot of cases where, you know, finance people or a controller gets the final say, and, you know, and cost becomes the all-consuming factor. I can't remember how many times I've been told that the company wants to be lean and mean, and what they, you know, usually start doing is slashing funding for supporting litigation.
Well, I can see where that would be a common event, especially in the current economic climate. Are you saying that doesn't work?
Well, you know, I'm saying all things in moderation. You know, rather than winding up with lean and mean, most organizations simply wind up emaciated and pissed off. You know, just slashing costs and going to the lowest cost provider for every service you've got, or, you know, trying to get your, you know, per diem attorneys for $2 cheaper than the guy down the street doesn't necessarily provide you with the best product. I mean, for those organizations where I was talking earlier about saying, you know, you've done this before, you know what the elemental costs are, you know how to build a price on something, they understand the importance of good quality inputs, good quality, you know, items to help to bolster whatever it is they're trying to put together. So the challenge is in demonstrating the value that's being provided for the amount of money that's being expended in litigation cost. It's no longer enough to toss out platitudes like, this is just the cost of doing business, so don't care what it costs. You know, that's naive. You've got to show how each dollar spent in litigation is either protecting or ameliorating, you know, many more in corporate earnings. You've got to make sure that cost containment is seen as being simply good business sense. You know, business people are fond of saying that they have to earn the money that we legal types like to spend. Executing the effective cost containment steps as part of a standard process will help the legal division to demonstrate that they understand the value of a dollar, and they understand that those dollars earned by the rest of the organization are important, and they're interested in adding to the financial health of the company while also defending its rights. You know, too often we get saddled with this moniker of, you know, these are just guys who are looking to spend our money. With all the talk about building bridges between legal and IT in the discovery process, the question of partnering with finance sometimes has been overlooked. And when people are cut out of a process, they can't support it. And when fiscal responsibility gets little attention, that's where legal and finance are going to get locked into a battle of the wills, and cost considerations are going to begin to override legal strategy. It's just best to avoid those issues by making sure that effective cost management is part of your standard process.
So what are your best tips for cost containment?
Well, I guess the biggest tip is know your spend, quickly followed by know your environment. You know, we've been talking about discovery costs as an industry for, you know, at least 9 years now that I think that you and I have been doing this kind of work. And plenty of people have gone to conferences and read magazine articles or followed online blogs and the like, but, you know, we're still stuck on the basics. You'd be amazed how many times they'll be called into a new engagement only to find out that the company has no idea of what they've spent up to that point. And this is the same company that's going to ask me in the next breath or two for, you know, two figures, what they're going to spend for an assessment and what they're going to spend in litigation costs. This way they can decide which one they like better. You know, do we do a case assessment or do we go straight to litigation? If you don't know what you're spending today, my biggest item for you would be, you know, start tracking. Find out what those costs are. Begin tracking the same costs in different vendor profiles or different law firm profiles to see what you're getting for your dollar in various areas. Once you understand what you've currently got, then if somebody comes in, you can speak knowledgeably with that person and say, well, here's what I've got on review, here's what I've got in collection. And most people in this industry, you know, I'm lucky to be the co-chair of the EDRM Code of Conduct Subcommittee. You know, I'd say 99 of 44, 100% of the people I've come across have been, you know, completely ethical and honest. And if you've got a good price, you know, they're going to tell you, well, that's a decent price. If you've got a price that's out of whack, they're going to tell you, either because it's going to benefit their organization or they're going to hope to steer you to a better opportunity. you know, after you find out your costs, you've got to know your environment. And again, these are discovery basics, I know, but it's something I still don't see happening in lots of organizations. I think there were so many people focused on getting the Fortune 50 or getting the Fortune 100 to clean up their operations, they forgot that there's something called the Russell 2000 out there. You know, there's thousands of other organizations who may not have gotten the message yet about, you know, how you get prepared for these events, how you get prepared for electronic discovery, or how you get prepared for litigation. And knowing your environment, what your data sources are, where your key systems reside, who your key custodians are, that's all going to provide the building blocks that will be used to develop an effective strategy for moving forward. You know, once you know what your spend is and the factors that influence that spend, you can start to investigate alternatives that provide you with cost containment without sacrificing legal defensibility.
Yeah, that middle market's something I've tried a number of shows when I was doing DNA broadcasts. It's really hard because there's not a lot of information out there, people that have a lot of experience in the middle market. But you're right, it's where most of the action can be. Most of the work needs to be done there too. So
right.
Well, Kevin, thanks again for joining us on the show.
Okay, my pleasure, Carl. Thanks for having me on.
And for all the listeners, for a complete list of shows, you can visit www.esibytes.com, where you can see the library and sign up on iTunes and download all the podcasts for free, or register for the show and get alerts when new shows are broadcast. And remember to listen to ESI Bytes before eDiscovery and ESI bites you back. Thank you again. This is Carl Shinneman. Have a good day.